Today's book in our book review slot is called The Lie of 1652, A Decolonized History of Land by prominent historian and heritage activist Patrick Tariq Mellett. It is a critique of the established pre-colonial and colonial history paradigms and tells of the story of dispossession, the destruction of livelihoods, and the brutality of slavery in South Africa. The Lie of 1652 is published by Tafelberg. Our author, Patrick Tariq Mellett, is a former liberation movement cadre. In 2009, his work on the intangible heritage of the Cape received a Western Cape Provincial Honours Award. In 2019, the Minister of Sport, Arts and Culture appointed him to the Governance Council of the South African Heritage Resources Agency. And for a number of years, Patrick Tariq Mellett has been active in the social media space on the issues of our early history and understanding what our history really is. Patrick Tariq Mellett, welcome to the show.
Shafiq, assalamu alaikum, and greetings to all your listeners out there.
And wa alaikum salam to you as well. The Lie of 1652, I don't know how we're going to cover everything, and I think the best thing to say right now is some people must rush out and buy it, and they'll get much, much more than what we're going to be discussing here. But first off the bat, I think what is interesting is that you start off with very early history, and I think a point you try to make is that South Africa or Southern Africa wasn't a land without a people for a people passing by who didn't have a land, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, look, you know, we've been brought up on this narrative about South Africa being this empty land, and it comes from an old papal concept of the doctrine of discovery, they call it, terra nullius, in which the papacy back in the 13th century already basically made it known to the Europeans that anywhere where there weren't Christians, there weren't really people. So there was this notion that in South Africa, there were just a few what they called noble savages, people who were half human, half beast, and nothing else. So the beginning of the book tackles this first lie, the lie of the empty land. Mm-hmm. And to be able to do that, I go back 3,000 years. I go back actually further, but start to sort of be more elaborate from about 3,000 years ago. And I deconstruct this myth that there were only San and Khoi people in South Africa, and only around about the 1500s was there a sudden black invasion into this empty land, but this was more or less at the same time that white people came, and therefore white people are no less alien than black people. It's a complete nonsense that had been developed by a historian by the name of Thiel in the 1800s. So I go back and I show people through archaeology, through paleontology, through genetic science, social history, on how, in fact, the peopling of South Africa first took place around the Sashe and Limpopo basin and river, and fanned out across South Africa, not in some mass invasion, but through a slow migratory drift that starts around 3,000 years ago and picks up around about 2,000 years ago. The fact of the matter is that, you know, South Africans were in fact trading with China, with Arabia, with Southeast Asia and India from around about 600 AD. Mm-hmm. The Europeans were in the Dark Ages at that stage. They hadn't yet started trading. Africa and South Africa, people were making steel around 500-600 AD. The Europeans made steel in the 1700s. So there is this paradigm of thinking that South Africa was kind of like in a Stone Age, at best early Iron Age, kind of primitive mode. There was no civilization here until the Europeans arrived in 1652. So that's the first myth that I knock out in the very first chapter.
Right.
And just to give your listeners an idea, when buying this book and reading this book, you can actually read each of these chapters as standalone, because they originally were five different papers. So, you don't have to get tired reading the whole thing at once.
Right.
Kind of take these five slices of history, because the next slice is all about 1652 itself, that there is this myth that Van Riebeeck arrives here and for the first time engages Khoi people, and Khoi people for the first time engage Europeans. There was a thriving port going on in Cape Town before Van Riebeeck for a whole half century. And in fact, over 1,071 ships just on outward bound journeys dropping anchor at Table Bay, 800 on homeward bound. You had something like over 120,000 people pass through the port from other countries before Van Riebeck arrived here. And Europeans had been staying here for between 3 weeks and 9 months in that half century. So the notion that, Van Riebeck arrives here and some kind of civilization arrives here, and before that there was just, beach bums. Achimoa, or Harry, as Van Riebeck refers to him, had already been to Java and back. He was considered to be a governor at the Cape. He was treated well by the English, for whom he was an agent of trade. There was a trading community at the Cape. Before Achimoa, back in 1613, Hore of the Horonaikwa people had gone to London and back. All of us, we've not been brought up with that history. We've been fed an untruth. And I can illustrate this in another way, because we accept too easily that what comes out of academic institutions even is the truth. Now, we were used to this fellow Jan van Riebeeck in the form of a picture that appeared on our banknotes, it appeared on our coins, statues, school books, and so on. That portrait is actually a plagiarized picture of a Mr. Vermeyden, who hangs in the Rijksgallery the Rijksmuseum Gallery in Amsterdam. The real picture of Van Riebeeck was always there, but he wasn't this handsome dude.
Yeah, it was pretty ugly, wasn't he? Yeah.
We were fed a lie.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's absolutely amazing, all of this. What led you to start thinking along these lines? Because what I also pick up in the book is that this has been a personal odyssey for you. I was just talking about it the other day at the radio station, and if you ask anybody anywhere, where do you come from, they have at least five different routes that this generation can remember. I mean, you've proved that there are absolutely hundreds. It's interesting, isn't it, that you went on this personal journey and discovered that you have the blood of so many different people in your DNA, it's no joke.
Yeah, look, it all starts for me as a kid. I grew up very poor. I had a single mother who worked in a laundry in District 6 in another street. I didn't know who my father was. I was in three foster homes before the age of seven. I went into a Terrible Dickensian Children's Asylum for 4 years after that. When I was just finishing my 15th year, I was out into work in a factory for 10 rand for a 6-day week.
Wow.
So, I had a very, very difficult upbringing. People would have said I come from a dysfunctional family, dysfunctional background, and so on. So as a child, I already was wrestling of who am I? Who do I belong to? Where do I belong? And it's from that journey, and the journey starts also in District 6. you know, when I was able to stay with my mum, which was always usually a few days at a time here and there, she would have to take me with her to work. And, of course, the company inspectors would come around and she would hide me in the laundry bags or send me to Auntie so-and-so nearby in the streets. And one of the places she sent me to was the Holy Cross Nuns up in Searle Street, Nile Street.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one particular nun who had this devotion for this black saint who lived 500 years ago, San Martino de Porres from Peru in Lima, from Lima in Peru. And I'd see this white German lady kneeling in front of this black statue of this man long dead and asking for advice. And then she talked to me about him. She said his mother was a slave, and she explained to me what slavery was and all of that. And I was about 8 years old. And I had this magnificent obsession about finding out about slavery starts then, and it starts too when I hear that my great grandmother on my maternal side, which, you know, is one step away from my granny, was born a slave. I started to then search, and over 40 years I discovered 28 enslaved persons in my family tree, 5 Khoi and 19 Europeans in the base family tree. But that was a 42-year journey around myself. In the process, when I was in my mid-40s, I discovered my father for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered that he had children with 4 women and that I had 13 siblings and,
right,
and all that sort of thing. But it starts at a very personal place. But that personal place also was about apartheid. And our family was a mix of poor white, colored, as in terms of classification of colored, and Indian. And we'd always been this mixed family, not just far away in history, but in my lifetime. And I had to confront race classification because, you know, I'm fair and Euro-looking and I'm trying to argue, but I am colored, and having a whole range of experience around this. And people forget today that there were 7 classifications of colored, not one. And one of those was other colored.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had to wrestle with all of these things as a youngster, going out to work, still a teen, and having to take decisions that would have life-changing results. I ended up taking up arms, you know, joining MK and end up across the border and fighting a political struggle. All of this around the issue of identity and heritage. And within that heritage, you know, heritage is your inheritance. What is it that we inherit? When people ask me, who are you? What are you? The first thing I will say to them is, I'm born of a people who rose above adversity. And that adversity was some of the worst forms of adversity: slavery, colonialism, genocide, de-Africanization, apartheid. And so I have a pride in an identity that isn't based on race, ethnicity, and color. It's based on facing these adversities and rising up above those adversities. In my studies then, over the years, because although I left school, you know, standard 8 and into the factory and so on, I studied at night. I never ever went full time to university, but I ended up getting a distinction for a Master of Science degree,
right,
in which the dissertation was on the indigenous Cape people and on Cape slavery as a heritage niche product within the tourism industry. So I then, through research and that, began to uncover, as I began to uncover my own enslaved ancestors, which were, you know, from Angola, from Sulawesi, from Madagascar, from India, from Myanmar, Thailand, you know, all over the world, plus locally born, I then also discovered many personalities. So I don't only know the details of DNA and genealogy, but I also know the stories behind the people. And what I have discovered through this is there's over 195 roots of origin that we have as the people of the Cape, what I refer to rather than colored as the Khamisa African people of the Cape. And that it's a wonderful array or tapestry of ancestry. And the story isn't a simple one of it's a mixture of black and white. In fact, over 70% of our ancestors are African. and the other 30% is a mix of Indian and Southeast Asian, Eurasian and European. But you cannot actually separate it out like that. So what I've done, and you'll see it in the book, I created a matrix about 15 years back of seven steps. You know, the iconic seven steps in
of District 6. Yes.
That inspired me to look at seven broad tributaries that we can say are our roots. And then under each of those broad tributaries, I then was able to plot a total of 195 sub-tributaries. And all of this, besides steps, that spoke to me of water, tributaries. And in Cape Town, we have a river that runs from Cape, from Table Mountain down to the sea. It's all covered over today, but it still runs underground, very much like our identities.
Exactly.
They're covered yeah. over, but it's still there, and it's beating, and its heartbeat is going. And then water, too. Without water, you cannot live. You know, I discovered that when I was 13 years old, and I did the solidarity fast with Bernard Rankmore, who fasted in protest at the Karamat on Signal Hill about the death of Imam Harun in detention. So when I then went on fast at my school, I didn't know that you must drink water. I thought you must just go without water and food. And, you know, 4 days later, I woke up in an infirmary. I passed out and so on. Water is the basic sustenance for humanity. It's also at the Sashe Limpopo River is where the early roots of the peopling of South Africa happened. And in the Cape, it's around the Camisa River where the early roots of the peopling of the Cape, where slaves or enslaved people came together with Khoi people, with other migrants of color, with free blacks, with non-conformist Europeans and so on. So I tell this whole story. But the story that I tell is also about 19 wars of dispossession over 227 years, how the land was lost. Land, identity, livelihoods, all of these are part of a mesh of dispossession. And our history doesn't tell us that story. So the lie of 1652 says, this is the distortion, and this is what actually happened. And then I say something else. I say to people, don't even believe me. Go and research yourself. That's why I have about 600 references and citations. It's to encourage people to ask questions. And it's only in asking questions that we can decolonize. It's not a single process. If somebody writes something like I did now one day, and suddenly this is decolonization. There's a huge amount of decolonizing that we have to do. And, you know, if we quote Marcus Garvey, which and Bob Marley made the same statement famous in his song, Redemption Song, none but ourselves can free our minds. And this book is to encourage people that only you yourself can free your mind. And when you do, that's when you start to have a personal liberation. So, you know, in taking a resistance road so many years back as a child and as a teen and so on, I have found personally a liberated life. Even although in terms of our country, we are far from liberated, we are still laboring under a lot of colonialism, and neocolonialism has become the new oppressive mechanism to keep us in our place.
Absolutely. Patrick, we're going to go for a quick break, and if you just hang online, just some headlines, and we're just going to go start to wrap things up. But very quickly before the break, the point that you made about our origin, 60-70% African, ironically, I've just finished doing exactly the same research. So what you say, 100%. But let's quickly go for the headlines. When we come back, we're talking to author Patrick Tariq Mellett about The Lie of 1652, A Decolonized History of Land by Tafelberg Publishers. Welcome back. We're discussing Patrick Tarek Millett's book, The Lie of 1652, A Decolonized History of Land. It looks like a big book. Don't worry. It's divided into very readable sections, and it's certainly a stimulating look at how we should be understanding our history. Patrick, I want you to tell our listeners the word Khamisa. What exactly does it mean? It's got a beautiful meaning.
Yes. In the old Kora language, which was the original language of the Khoi, and also in Nama or Kwekwekwap today, Khama is water, or Khamis is water. So Khamis Sa, water for all. When we talk of water, we're talking about sweet water, water that you can drink, as opposed to saline or salty water. So sweet water for all. And that is the name of the river. Now, and unlike the Europeans, the indigenous people didn't give affectionate different names to different rivers. It was simply the salty water, or it was the drinking water. So Khamisa is the name of a drinking water river. You see it in Sutjikhama as well. You see it in Kafakhama. The word, you know, the Khaiskhama, it appears all over South Africa. So Khama or Khamis is water, and that's the giver of life. Now, the people who first started trading with the European shipping, I say European because it was French, Dutch, Portuguese, Danish, and English ships that had come through from around 1600 to 1652. And the small trading community led by Khore and then later on by Achamar were known as the Amakwa, or the Watermans, the water people. So again, this connection of people and our earliest ancestors and the water. Van Riebeeck disparagingly referred to them as Distanflopers, and fellow Khoi people disparagingly referred to them as Korinaikona, which isn't the name of a people. It's a disparaging remark about you, the people that deserted us or left us. The name that people use for themselves, and this is written by Van Riebeeck, the name they preferred to be known as was Watermans or Khamakwa. So it's got a very, very beautiful meaning. I alluded earlier to the fact that this river with many tributaries, and today even there's about 40 springs around Cape Town that all come from the Khamisa river system. Now, that's all paved over today by streets, tars, pavements, buildings. But underneath Cape Town, and you actually can go on tours, you know, underground tours of Cape Town nowadays, through these tunnels where this fresh water is still flowing into the sea. Now, the comparison of people who are classified as colored, having their history driven underground in the same way as the water has been driven underground. And what I challenge in my book is one of the chapters is actually dedicated to showing where the term colored came from and how it was used to divide African people into those who spoke Bantu languages and those who did not. And those who spoke Bantu language, which was about over 70 different peoples, were panel-beated into 9 linguistic national groups and called natives. And people who were called colored were people of over 50 groups that were also panel-beated. And if you go and you look at the census in 1904, the last census that called people by their different names of Kurana and Damara, Krikwa, Nama, San, Mazbikar, and so on, it suddenly gets washed away with the Union of South Africa in 1911, and only the term colored is used. So that chapter is very important because it deals with our contemporary scenario. Because people are still using the apartheid silos to put people into this black, white, colored, Indian paradigm. We have diversity in South Africa, but it isn't race diversity. Mm. It is a diverse heritage. And we should be able to celebrate an African heritage, an Afro-European heritage, and an Afro-Asian heritage. Not colors and not ethnicities and races. We are one human race, and modern genetics has proved that over and over again. So I'm hoping that this Heritage Month and Heritage Day, that we begin to shift our paradigm of thinking away from these apartheid silos into moving in a direction where one day we can say we are one people with multiple heritages which we share and defend collectively rather than group-wise. So it's a different paradigm that I'm putting across.
No, look, I mean, I like your terminologies, Afro-Europeans, Afro-Asians, etc. I mean, it's so obvious, but you're the guy that's coined it. And you make the point indirectly, in a sense, that if a lot of white people would regard themselves as Afro-Europeans, they could change their mindset and realize exactly where their roots are, because there are people, Afro-Europeans, in this country who've been here for 5 or 6 generations. Why would they still want to call themselves as European? Just as a silly example.
All whites.
Exactly.
You know, they complain when we tackle racism and whitism. The answer is join us in tackling it. You know, what is dignified about seeing yourself as a color? You cannot get away from the fact that you have a European heritage, but a European heritage within an African environment, mm-hmm. as Afro-Europeans. You can be proud and share that with Africans and with Afro-Asians, but why defend whiteism? Because with whiteism comes white supremacy and comes colonialism and imperialism. That's what you're defending. And so, you know, we reach out and to fellow South Africans, regardless of their heritage, and say, let's hold hands and move forward into the future. But don't bring your baggage of whiteism with you. You've got to set that aside. And that then is a much clearer message than simply saying to people, well, you're going to never be accepted by us because that's who you are. And, you know, that is not what our message is all about. Our message is one of decolonize yourself, de-imperialize yourself, join us hand in hand to build a nation in the making. In my opinion, we don't actually have a common nation in South Africa. We at best have a nation in the making, and it's up to all of us to band together to make that. You know, some people say, oh, why can't we just all be South Africans? Well, South Africa, the concept was only, you know, decided upon 110 years ago, and it was decided upon by two warring European factions.
Yes.
So we've got to get our head around the fact that, in fact, there's a greater cousin connection across Southern Africa. We are the people of Mzansi, and we are Southern Africans, and we also have an African identity. But what binds us? What are the ties that bind us? And we have to look at all the adversities faced and how adversities were tackled and how we triumphed over adversities. And part of that story includes the many Afro-Europeans, going back to Coenraad de Beys, going back to Johannes van der Kemp, right up to Joe Slover, who sacrificed and went against the grain. That is the difference between those people who oppressed and murdered and created genocide. We cannot take that with us into the future. You know, I spoke at the press club the other day, and I mentioned a man by the name of Adolf Sailor Malan. And very few South Africans know who he is. But he was one of the Battle of Britain ace fighter pilots, and he came from Wellington. Called him Sailor because he started on the seas as a 15-year-old and changed to flying. When he returned after the Second World War, incensed by fascism, he started a movement called the Torch Commando, which went on mass protest marches against apartheid. At that time, they were taking the vote away from people classified as colored. His memory, he died in 1963, has been totally obliterated by whitism. So here's an Afro-European who has contributed to the struggle in South Africa, is not known And he's not known, not because black people don't want to know him. It's because white people suppressed his memory because they didn't agree with him. Now, that's what I mean about decolonizing and relooking as far as the white community is concerned. But as far as the rest of us are concerned, there is so much in our history and heritage that we can celebrate. And we are a tough people, and we're a succeeding people, and we've overcome so much. The divisions that were created by apartheid, we've got to look at them and we've got to tackle them. We have cousin connections across these so-called Bantu speaker lines and non-Bantu speaker lines and so on and that. We are one African people. The Khamisa African that I talk about and talk of about myself as is one who is Africa conscious, Southern African conscious, proudly Mzanzi and not divisionist. And I can only hope and pray that the ANC government sees sense. You know what happened is, sorry to use the analogy of wine. But
no problem.
People who take old wineskins and pour new wine into it, two things happen. The wine turns sour and the wineskins burst. And this is unfortunately what the ANC has done. It's poured old wine of apartheid into new wine post-1994 into the old apartheid wineskins. And there's a sourness and there is a situation where it's about to burst. We've got to leave this race silo nonsense aside. And as much as apartheid distorted history, we also have ethno-nationalists, ethno-black nationalists who are also distorting history. We were part of a national liberation struggle, not an ethno-nationalist struggle. And there is so much parallels of Verwoerdian nationalism in what I call ethno-nationalism that has crept into the ANC, and also this whole concept of firstism. It's another form of Verwoerdianism. We need to move away from that, embrace each other, and walk bravely into the future with each other. So as much as we must tackle the colonialism of the past, we've got to tackle the neo-colonialism of the present. And that's a huge challenge before us today.
Patrick Tariq Mellett, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. We've been talking about his latest book, The Lie of 1652, A Decolonized History of Land. I've got hold of the book, and it's going to have a treasured place in my bookshelf, that is for sure. And it is available at a bookshop near you via Tafelberg Publishers. Patrick, well done on the book, and may it fly off the shelves. I know it's going to.
Great. Thanks, Afik. There's a huge demand already.
Enjoy.
Okay. Great stuff. Thank you, my brother.